This episode contains graphic descriptions of real medical scenarios faced by real medical professionals. Listener discretion is advised. From Knowledgeable Provider, this is Critical Incident. So I'm going to try adding a new segment here on the podcast. I think everyone who works in the medical field accumulates interesting stories. When you're seeing people at their worst, at their most vulnerable, during their worst moments, it doesn't take long to start experiencing some things that are quite different from what you might experience in normal day-to-day life. And I assume everyone in medicine, especially in more acute care situations, gets asked now and then, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? Or what's the grossest thing you've ever seen? Or what's the craziest thing you've ever seen? And I've never really figured out how I should respond to that question. I don't think I've ever really knocked it out of the park, in part because I'm just not that great of a conversationalist. I need time to think about and plan what I'm going to say. So it's really hard for me to come up with any kind of dazzling story on the spot like that. It's also the case for me, and I think this is a fortunate thing, that I don't tend to dwell on the things that I've seen and done over the years. In general, things don't stick with me or bother me so much as long as I feel like I did my job well or tried to do everything I could do in a given situation. For whatever reason, I've never been prone to nightmares, flashbacks, PTSD kind of stuff. I have struggled a lot with depression at times, times like, you know, the first 35 years of my life, but that was around way before I ever got into any kind of medical role. It seems like, at least in the public safety community, and I would guess the military community as well, from what I've seen, it seems like the general consensus is that it's not really all that nice to ask someone a question like that, because you are asking them to relive things that may have been super traumatic, or were definitely super traumatic to someone, but may also have been super traumatic for them. So you're sort of asking people to relive the worst things they've ever seen just for entertainment value. But I know people have no ill intent when they ask that, so I don't tend to get offended or react to it that way. But unfortunately, the things that come to my mind when somebody asks me that question are all the hardest things. I don't tend to remember the crazy, zany, exciting things that people are probably looking for when they ask that question. The things that stick in my mind are just super sad for the most part. And so when I've tried to respond to that question, it usually goes one of two or three ways. I either just say, oh, I'm not really good at that game and let it pass. Or I tell some story that I think is interesting, but evidently nobody else does because they sort of lose interest. Or I answer it honestly and tell some very sad, horrible story that sort of brings the mood down. I talked about this with my husband before, and he told me I should just make up some insane, entertaining story and just keep it in my back pocket to whip out and tell. Because, of course, whoever's asking the question is not going to know whether it's true or not. And honestly, that's probably the best answer. But I think I'm a bad liar, and I'm very uncomfortable with anything other than transparency. I think mostly with me, what you see is what you get. And I don't know that I could pull off something like that convincingly. And I know I would feel bad. I would feel disingenuous answering the question that way. So anyway, I've been thinking about all this, and I was thinking that maybe people would be interested in hearing stories of some of the things I've seen and done over the years. And for me, a podcast is the perfect place to share that because I don't feel on the spot. I have plenty of time to plan out, think about what I'm going to say, and make sure it's presented in the way I want it to be presented. I was worried that maybe I don't actually remember enough things that would be interesting to make episodes out of. So the other night, I pulled up a blank document on my laptop, and within an hour, just off the top of my head, I came up with like 75 things that I thought would be interesting to talk about or that I would like to share. So I guess I do have some stories. I'm probably not that good at telling them, and maybe it will turn out that they're not interesting to anybody except me. But I'm going to give it a shot for a while and see how it goes. So right now, I think I'm going to try to put out one of these episodes on the weeks in between the regular episodes of the podcast. What I think I would also enjoy doing is telling other people's stories or letting other people tell their stories. So that's what I made the outro of this segment of the podcast about. If you have any stories that you would like to share, I would be happy to read them on the podcast if you want to send them to me in writing. Or you can record yourself talking about it, send it to me, and I'll just play your recording. Or we can talk about it together live. We could do that remotely or in person. There are other podcasts where they're already doing this. I noticed one the other day called Stories from the Road, First Responder Stories with Phil Klein. That seems to be the most active or prevalent one of these, at least according to a cursory Google search. I like the idea of keeping it a part of the same podcast because it sort of highlights, in a way, this kind of duality of medicine or of working in medicine. You know, you have the very high-minded intellectual pursuit of studying science and anatomy, physiology, biochemistry, learning about the body. And then you have the reality of dealing with the bodies of actual people. And in my experience, much of the time, there's nothing at all high-minded or glamorous about that part of the experience of working in medicine, especially out in the world in an ambulance or in the emergency room. I can only speak for myself, but I'm pretty sure I have seen this in coworkers and colleagues over the years, where you sort of develop this dual personality, where you kind of have the kind, professional, caregiving side that you want to project to your patients. But then there's also this dark side, which is just savage and jaded and sarcastic, that tends to come out more when you're behind closed doors with your coworkers and peers or after hours. And most of the time, those two parts stay appropriately separate from one another. But in extreme circumstances, that other side can come out if need be with a patient who's being super inappropriate or ridiculous or whatever. That doesn't happen so much in the situation I'm working in now. But boy, does it ever happen in the field and in the emergency room, where sometimes the only thing that people understand is sort of getting down on their level or pushing back, fighting back against their behavior. And maybe everyone understands that to some degree. Maybe this is not as exclusive to medicine or emergency medicine as I'm making it out to be. I would imagine the same is true for anyone who works with the public in any capacity, and maybe even among coworkers who just work in an office that are not public facing, but still have to deal with each other all day. I don't know. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. This is the segment of the podcast where I'm going to tell some stories from over the years and maybe share your stories from over the years as well. I'll start with the very first story that came to mind when I started compiling my list. And maybe this will give you a sense of why I don't come up with super fun answers to this question in social settings. This call, probably more than any other in my career, is one that stuck with me for a long time, and one that I used to find myself thinking back on a lot when things were not going well, when I was feeling down. I've been involved with a lot worse situations since this happened, but there was just something about the particular circumstances and the time in my life and in my career when it happened, where it just kind of hit differently. So this happened out in Cherokee, Alabama, which is a very small town in western Colbert County. We moved there when I was 16. And this is a place where the fire and EMS services at the time were completely volunteer. They did have a paid police department with one officer on duty. So very small, very rural, gigantic territory to try to cover with a handful of volunteers. So we move out there, and my parents had both been police officers and EMTs at one point in their lives. And so they encouraged me to try it, to get involved. And that's really where my whole career in medicine started. They had a, I guess what you would typically call an explorer program, although I don't know that it was an official explorer post. I don't think so. But they had a program where even as a 16-year-old high school kid, you could hop on the ambulance and go to emergency calls and learn about how all that worked. It was a full ALS transport service. However, most of the time, there were not ALS providers around. So the typical crew would be a basic EMT and then a driver. And by that, I mean somebody who had a license from the state that said ambulance driver, who took an EVOC course, and then a third crew member who we called a rookie, who was just basically another set of hands who was there to learn more than anything else, but also to help. Of course, in those situations where you only have three people, you're not going to sit back and watch, right? You're going to be in there doing stuff. So this particular call happened after I'd been volunteering there for a few years. I was a licensed EMT by that time. I was not a paramedic. So I believe I was 19 years old and an intermediate EMT. So the call comes in as a car accident, MVA, MVC. I don't know. I have no memory of how it was dispatched. Cherokee's pretty way out in the sticks. Even in the middle of Cherokee, you're pretty far from any kind of emergency room. If I remember right, it's at least 30 minutes to the hospital from the closest points in the coverage area. And from there, it only gets further. Some of the places in the rescue squad's coverage area were like probably an hour from a hospital by ground. And this call was on out in the coverage area. It was not close to anything. Windy, rural, two-lane road. So what happened was this carload full of teenagers crashed. And from kind of walking around and looking at the crash site afterwards, it looked like they probably dropped their wheels off of one side of the road, overcorrected, and then ended up in the ditch on the other side of the road. I call it a ditch. It was somewhere between a ditch and a ravine. It was a big enough hole that there was waist-deep water, and the car was completely off the road on its side. So we get out there, and I don't remember exactly who was with us or how many responders were around, but in my memory, it was me and two other people, at least when we initially got there. And keep in mind, this was 22 years ago, so I'm sure a lot of the details have left me, so forgive me if I make any contradictory statements about minor details. But what I remember is hopping down into this ditch, wading through this waist-deep water to get to the side of this car. So I'm looking in the driver's side window. Three people inside. One in the back seat appears completely unharmed, and two in the front seat, both completely unresponsive. I only have a brief flash of an image of the kid in the back seat. I think he kind of scrambled out, and I didn't really see him again. And when I say kids, I mean like 16, 17 years old. Old enough to be out driving around, but just barely. Which, as I'm thinking about that now, it's kind of funny because I was only a couple years older than that, out driving around in an ambulance and expected to handle these situations. So anyway, kid in the back seat is fine. He scrambles out of the car. Do not remember seeing him again. Now we're left with two in the front seat, both unresponsive. The passenger's laying on top of the driver, which probably means he didn't have a seatbelt on. It seems like I remember the driver had a seatbelt on, the passenger did not. But anyway, passenger was on top of driver. So I get in there and start assessing. The driver is unresponsive but breathing, has a pulse. The passenger who's laying on top of him is dead, pulseless apneic. I don't remember seeing any big gruesome wounds. It must have all just been internal kind of injuries. I don't remember how long it actually took us to get there. If he drove out there straight from where the ambulance was kept, I think it would probably be 10 minutes maybe. But in those situations, of course, you're responding from home or wherever you happen to be. So it was definitely not unusual for us to have 20, 30 minute response times. So it had been a while since the accident occurred. In general, with traumatic arrests, as in somebody who is a victim of blunt trauma and whose heart has stopped, who has stopped breathing, generally speaking, you do not work those patients. And the rationale there is if something happened that's so bad that they died before we got there, there's nothing that we can do now to reverse that. And especially in the whatever 20, 30 minutes, an hour it takes us to get that person to the hospital. And over there in the Shoals, that would not even be to a trauma center where they have a trauma surgeon. There's just no chance of doing anything that's going to change the outcome there. So blunt traumatic arrest, generally they get pronounced dead in the field and that's it. Sometimes it's a little different depending on the situation. In this particular situation, with it being a kid, a child, and in this small town where everyone knows everybody, that definitely factors into stories like this as well. In another situation, we might have tried to work this kid. But in this situation, essentially what I had, was a mass casualty incident. That just means that you have more patients than you have resources to deal with. So when you have one ambulance, two helpers, one EMT, and three patients, that meets the definition until you get more help. So really what I had was a small mass casualty incident. That sounds like an oxymoron. What I had was more patients than I had resources to take care of. I had one green tag, one black tag, and one red tag. So I make the decision, okay, this one's dead. We're not working this one. Moving on to the next. But the thing was, he was laying on top of the patient that I really needed to get to. And the way this car was oriented, there was no moving him over into the passenger seat. There was no pulling him out the other side. The only way to get him out was to pull him out through the driver's window or through the driver's door. But anyway, he had to come out that side and he had to come out now so I could get to the other kid. So I remember someone to my left, we're both reaching down into this car trying to get a hold of this body to pull it out of the way. And we're struggling. He was not a huge person, but he was, you know, probably normal adult size by that point. So it's a struggle. And I noticed that the person behind me was not doing much to help. I kept sort of directing the body that way because that's the way it had to go to get out of the way. And I was just sort of, I just remember sensing inertia, nothing happening from this other person. Well, here's the thing. And this probably is why this sticks with me more than any other reason. It turns out that the person behind me was related to the dead person we were trying to pull out of this car. And I believe he had realized it at that point. I don't think it was just the shock of realizing that you're working with dead teenagers. I think he had realized it at that point and was just sort of shell-shocked. Of course, I didn't know this until after the fact, but he did hang in there. He stayed in there, and eventually we were able to get the first person out. And I have this other flash of memory where by this time we had pulled him out. He had been pulled up onto the road. There was more help there at this point. And they have him on the stretcher. I believe he's covered with a sheet. And somebody yells at me and goes, "We're not working this one, right?" And I said something similar to, "No, he's dead. We're not working him." And I remember him being put in the ambulance. Doors are closed. That's it. And that's a decision that has haunted me probably more than any other I've dealt with in my career. Oh, I'm not going to say that. No, maybe not. But it's top two or three. And I know I made the right decision. Even if this had happened in the middle of Huntsville, right next to the trauma center, I had 20 responders on the scene. That was still the right decision. Trauma arrest, call it and be done with it. But because it turned out he was related to this other crew member who was also young, we were all very young, I didn't hear the end of that for a long time. And I mean explicit statements like, "Well, what if it was God's plan that he was supposed to live and we didn't try to do anything to help him?" That is a hard thing to deal with. That would be hard for me to deal with now. It was pretty devastating to 19-year-old me. And really, that's why I guess this is a big deal in my head, just because of that whole aftermath and having to relive and relive and relive and all that stuff. I don't guess I've ever really talked it out like this, but that must be why it was such a big deal and why it has stuck in my memory for so long. So, okay, now attention's turned to the patient who's still alive, was breathing, had a pulse, again, no super obvious injuries, was completely unresponsive. So now our task is to get him out of the car. Then in that situation, you have to balance, well, you know, I need to get to him quickly so that I can make sure his airway is patent and, you know, do what we need to do. And I got to get him out of this car, obviously. But we don't know if he has a spinal injury, so we have to be a little bit careful as far as manipulating his head and neck and back and keeping everything in line. I don't really remember the process of getting him out. Maybe I tried messing around with the KED, which is like a little, it's sort of like one of those LSO braces that the idea of it is to stabilize the spine while the patient's in a seated position. Thinking that now just sounds sort of crazy because the priority action would have been to open his airway and get moving rather than screw around with putting that KED on, which takes a long time. I don't remember how we did it, but we did get him out. I assume we put him on a backboard. And by the time all that had transpired, the helicopter had landed. When I first started in Cherokee, there was no helicopter. You were not getting a helicopter. You could forget it. But AeriVac came into the area, put a base in Muscle Shoals. And for the first time, we had relatively quick access to air transport. And that was an absolute game changer out there. I remember what a cool thing that was and what an amazing resource that was when that finally became available. So that was a good time for them to be there. I remember having him out on a backboard, hauling him up out of this ditch / ravine. And basically, we just put him straight in the helicopter and they left. I don't think he ever went in the ambulance. I don't think we ultimately did a lot of treatment at the scene. I assume they intubated him and somebody got an IV started. I know I didn't intubate him. I think I would remember that. Surely those two things happened before they lifted off. I don't know. But I believe he actually coded in the helicopter on the way to the hospital. I don't know which hospital they were going to or which hospital they ended up at. I just know that he died. And so now we're left on the scene. I assume the kid who was not hurt was still around somewhere. The dead kid was in our ambulance. And there was nothing else to do. And that's a really weird sensation, a really weird feeling after you've been in this state of adrenaline and having a task, having something to do, you know, fast movements for however long, and then suddenly you're done and there's nothing else to do. And you kind of just don't know what to do with yourself. I don't really have much of a memory of what happened after that. I don't know how his body got out of our ambulance. Out there, we did sometimes transport dead bodies from the scene to the funeral home, really just to help out the funeral home more than anything else. So I don't know if that happened. I assume the coroner came. Yeah, I don't know. Now that I'm thinking about it, I have zero memory of what transpired after the second patient left the scene. The one other specific thing I remember, this is ridiculous, somehow we ended up with this kid's shoe, the dead kid's shoe. We're back at the ambulance station, you know, we've cleaned everything up, and I guess somehow the shoe ended up getting left in the ambulance. So I've got this bloody shoe in a, you know, red trash bag. And I'm like, what do we do with this shoe? And someone told me, don't worry about it, just throw it away, which was 100% the correct answer. But I felt bad doing it. For whatever reason, it seemed like the wrong thing to do, to throw this poor kid's shoe away after everything else that the family had gone through. So I decided I'm going to take it back, meaning I took it over to the funeral home where he was and where his family was. I don't know how much time had passed. Surely it was the same day. I can't imagine that I would have kept a bloody shoe around in a bag for multiple days. I think it was the same day. It had been long enough that there was somebody that knew him was at the funeral home. So anyway, oh, I'm cringing even talking about this. It's so cringy. I bebopped on down to the funeral home with this bloody shoe in a bag and showed up and was like, hey, does anyone want this shoe? Oh my God. I mean, I didn't say it like that, but in my mind's eye, I'm seeing big, stupid me bounding around with this damn bloody shoe in a trash bag, trying to get rid of it so my conscience is clear. Oh, what a dumbass. I can only imagine how that must have been received. I don't even remember what happened to the fucking shoe. I guess somebody took it. Maybe I ended up just throwing it away. I don't know. That was the pitiful end to the already tragic, terrible situation. So that will be the first critical incident segment. And I'm guessing now you understand why people don't stick around to listen to my answers to that question when they ask, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? But I hope you'll stick around for more stories and more episodes of Knowledgeable Provider. Right now, it's time for this cool new outro I made. I would love to share your critical incident on the podcast. If you have a story you want to tell, send it to me by email at thekppod@gmail.com. That's thekppod@gmail.com. You can send it in writing and I'll read the story. You can make a high quality recording of yourself telling the story and I'll play that. Or I can interview you about it, either remotely or in person. Thank you for listening. And as always, stay safe, take care of yourself, and take care of your patients in that order.